Muito bom dia a todos. Bem-vindos à Universidade de Évora e à cidade de Évora. Nós vamos dar início aos trabalhos. Eu penso que ainda não terá a tradução a ser realizada, mas terá só mais um minuto. Até que os colegas operem devidamente os aparelhos de tradução. Sintonizados neste momento. Então, eu vou reiniciar. Bem-vindos à Universidade de Évora, bem-vindos a Évora, bem-vindos ao Alentejo, região do sul de Portugal. Nós vamos retomar os nossos trabalhos da 16ª Conferência Interparlamentar Eureka, de 2009, e iremos aqui hoje, neste momento, fazer uma pequena sessão de recepção e de boas-vindas, pois temos connosco o Sr. Reitor da Universidade de Évora, o Sr. Jorge Araújo, e o Sr. Presidente da Câmara Municipal de Évora, o Dr. José Ernesto de Oliveira. Eles estão aqui para vos dar as boas-vindas e eu vou passar a palavra imediatamente ao Sr. Reitor da Universidade de Évora, o Sr. Professor Jorge Araújo.
Yeah. essa gente foi rápida entre a fusão cênica e a outra. Et la idéologie, donc, des bâtiments qui étaient créés à la ville. Celle-ci, la construction que vous allez voir, l'architecture a été conçue exactement pour accueillir l'université. C'est la première construction scolaire. En regardant le fronton de l'université, vous allez trouver deux figures féminines. Donc, il s'agit d'un à l'époque.
Thank you.
biológico que existe, conhecimento de séculos XVI, fundamentalmente séculos XVI, séculos XV, séculos XVI, séculos XVI, séculos XVII, foi Portugal um país importante na Europa, numa perspectiva de conhecimento, da transmissão de conhecimento, da instituição, do pensamento, das artes, da cultura, e é pelo futuro um papel determinante nessa época. Portanto, esta necessidade de patrimônio da humanidade, de ter necessidade,
Ora, uma ou duas informações prévias ao painel. Nós recebemos ontem, durante a tarde, durante a noite e durante a madrugada de hoje e durante a manhã de hoje, estamos a receber as vossas propostas, os vossos contributos para o nosso projeto de resolução e queremos desde já agradecer-vos o trabalho extraordinário que têm feito nessas vossas propostas, que muito têm enriquecido e melhorado o texto de base que nós vos disponibilizamos. Nós estamos ainda a incorporar algumas das propostas que hoje mesmo deram entrada aqui no secretariado e pensamos estar em condições, no final deste painel, de vos apresentar o texto que resulta da inclusão da esmagadora a maioria, se não a totalidade das vossas propostas para a resolução. Nós estamos a terminar esses trabalhos, mas não queremos deixar naturalmente de vos dizer que se houver ainda mais alguma proposta que terão, digamos, a possibilidade de a apresentar junto do secretariado desta conferência interparlamentar e nós certamente faremos com que ela seja integrada para que possa ser apresentada conjuntamente com o texto global. Portanto, agradeço muito a vossa colaboração, que tem sido fantástica e que tem, como disse, enriquecido muito e melhorado muito o nosso texto base. Nós temos um dia hoje muito preenchido, temos um painel que nos vai hoje falar uma vez mais, porque já falámos ontem das questões energéticas e de sustentabilidade. Vamos falar hoje um pouco da realidade a portuguesa. Temos o professor Rui Namorado Rosa, que é professor catedrático desta Universidade de Évora, a quem eu agradeço muito a disponibilidade que desde logo teve para estar connosco esta manhã, e o professor Paulo Ferrão, coordenador do protocolo que existe hoje entre o Estado português e o MIT. Protocolo que, digamos, tem promovido um intercâmbio muito interessante em termos científicos e não só, ele irá explicar melhor, entre algumas instituições portuguesas e essa importante instituição norte-americana. Seguidamente iremos fazer, digamos, um breve intervalo para que nós possamos, digamos, congregar todas as vossas propostas e tentar construir um texto final do projeto de resolução, cerca de 10, 15 minutos, que também vos dará a oportunidade de fazerem, digamos, um pequeno coffee break, e depois apresentaremos a proposta da, digamos, da presidência da Comissão para o projeto de resolução. A cerimónia de encerramento irá ocorrer, enfim, de acordo com o programa, cerca das 12h15. Não iremos ter aqui a presente o Sr. Presidente da Comissão Parlamentar de Educação e Ciência por a impossibilidade de última hora institucional que o impede de estar aqui hoje connosco, mas a cerimónia de sessão, diremos, decorrerá normalmente. Interromperemos os nossos trabalhos na parte final da manhã, por volta das 12h30, 12h45, e iremos almoçar, mesmo aqui em frente, no restaurante da Universidade, um almoço que é oferecido pelo Sr. Reitor da Universidade de Évora. Ou antes ou após o almoço faremos uma pequena visita à Universidade de Évora, que é muito bonita, como já foi aqui apresentada previamente pelo Sr. Reitor, e da parte da tarde, como está no nosso programa, visitaremos duas unidades de produção de energia elétrica, a primeira delas localizada numa freguesia que se chama Amareleja, pertence ao concelho, ao município de Moura, no Baixo Alentejo, e temos aqui um senhor deputado do Baixo Alentejo, do grupo parlamentar do Partido Comunista Português, a quem eu agradeço a sua presença, o Sr. Deputado José Soeiro, que certamente, digamos, também, não sei se terá a oportunidade de nos acompanhar, eu penso que sim, portanto, iremos estar em terras que são da sua responsabilidade e ele certamente, como sempre faz, receber-nos-á bastante bem, de forma bastante simpática. Iremos depois visitar um empreendimento múltiplo, que é o empreendimento do Alqueva, tem, entre outras valências, uma valência hidroelétrica, produção de energia elétrica a partir de fonte hídrica, propriedade da EDP, Energias de Portugal, que tivemos ontem, digamos, a presença de um dos seus administradores, o engenheiro Jorge Cruz de Moraes. E, finalmente, porque não é só trabalho que estas conferências também têm, teremos um momento mais informal e de convívio numa das explorações agrícolas mais conhecidas do Alentejo, que é a herdade do Esporão, onde poderemos desfrutar daquelas iguarias e daqueles vinhos que são o melhor que o Alentejo tem, porque são a simbiose perfeita entre a tradição, entre a nossa cultura e muita tecnologia que hoje está presente na produção desses produtos que são hoje produtos certificados e produtos que são a nossa melhor bandeira do ponto de vista da nossa produção agroindustrial. Espero que gostem deste dia que preparamos para vós. Eu não irei gastar mais tempo a apresentar-vos o dia. Irei passar de imediato a palavra ao Sr. Professor Rui Numerado Rosa.
Good morning. I am addressing you in English. I believe that most of you will be more knowledgeable on English than on Portuguese, so I think it might make life a little easier. I am very honored to have been invited by the chairman of this conference to address you. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity of speaking before such a distinguished audience about such an important issue as energy and sustainability. So, ladies and gentlemen, honorable members of parliament and other honorable authorities, what I have to do is to fetch my message. And I thank you for the opportunity of doing so. In a first moment, Portugal and Europe, very briefly. You can see that the total primary energy supply of Portugal has been growing steadily along the years, with a large contribution from oil and also some renewable energy components. Energy production, domestic energy production, is represented only about 15% of the total energy supply. So Portugal is heavily dependent on imports. And here you find what is the domestic production. According to the data provided by International Energy Agency. This other graph shows the consumption of oil products. That's the main primary energy source is oil, imported oil. And we see here the importance of heavy fuel oil and middle distillates. That means fuel for transportation and steel fuel for heating. Not very noble use of oil products. So that's some room for improvement. Here you can see the composition and the growth of the electricity generation with a base load of coal, imported coal, at the moment all imported coal, hydroelectric, that's an important component, and you'll visit an important dam this afternoon, have that opportunity, and of lately, also in green, you find a composition, input, important input of gas, maybe not a very noble use for gas to produce electricity, but that's the case. Overall, we see that in 25 years' time, roughly, there has been an important growth in consumption, mainly in industry and in transport sector, also in the building sector, but industry and transport sector. Now, referring for a while to this university, in this university we develop energy research, development and demonstration in a number of fields, some with more in-depth, others we are beginning. And I mention some of them. They are over there, solar radiation resource and thermal and electrical power technologies, wind resource and technology, geological resources identification and assessment, geological reservoirs as far as hydrocarbon, geological sequestration of CO2 and geothermal resource, biomass production and conversion into fuels, ocean resources prospection and assessment, autonomous electrical energy provision, grid integration management and stability, built environment conditioning and domotics, efficient energy conversion and storage technologies. All these are issues of our interest and to more or less extent our abilities and skills. Here you can have some images illustrating our work. We work, for instance, observation of the Earth from, in particular, climate, weather conditions and climate, both using satellite platforms and surface instrumentation platforms. On that corner you can see just a surface platform standing or floating on the dam that you are visiting this afternoon, and where you can study the microclimate and study the composition of the atmosphere. Down you see how we have contributed to the development of the geothermal atlas of Europe, and also how we are contributing for the extension of the continental platform under Portuguese jurisdiction in the framework of the Treaty of Oceans. Our work is not done in isolation, it's done in context of cooperation, international cooperation, regional cooperation, and in at national level in contributing for a consortium that is being built up among state laboratories, universities, and research units. We also cooperate with a number of enterprises, and they are partners in a number of our projects. If you look at the European Union, you have here roughly an image of that depicts the resources, fuel resources in the European Union. For comparison, in the corner there are worldwide resources of the same fuels, coal, oil and gas. So Portugal is not very well endowed with fossil resources. That's why you are 85% dependent on imports for energy supply. But the situation for the European Union as a whole is not much better. European Union indigenous primary energy production is depleting. European Union energy production satisfies less than half of its needs. And we import, European Union, oil from OPEC, 38% Russia, 33% Norway, 16% and so on. And as far as gas is concerned, Russia 42%, Norway 24%, Algeria 18% and so on. So we are, as European Union, heavily dependent on a very few number of providers of suppliers of gas and oil. Sources of coal imports are also less concentrated, the largest suppliers being of coal being Russia and South Africa, but there are several other ones of importance. So the situation is not so constrained. In this picture, we see the flows of crude oil around the world, inter-regional flows of crude oil. And you see different arrows pointing into Europe, coming from Russia, coming from Africa, coming from the Middle East. That's our international dependence from oil. And if you look eastwards, we have a grid of pipelines, oil and gas pipelines, supplying the European Union, coming from Russia and from other nations around the Caspian Sea. And in particular, if you look into gas, you have a more extensive grid of gasoducts coming from the east, some being planned to be built in blue, and some coming from south, from Africa, from North Africa and Middle East. That's a very important connection as well. Depicted are also the ports equipped for liquefied natural gas imports that Portugal has such installation nearby in Sines, and also the reservoirs for having reserves for providing for shortcomings. The European Union very recently issued a second strategic energy review and has provided a number of scenarios for the year 2020 in just over 10 years' time. And we can realize that whatever the scenario, whatever the effort, whatever the price of the oil that has been considered, that the primary energy demand and the primary energy imports will stay very high. So we have a problem in Europe. But now I should like to address the energy and sustainability from the wider point of view. We have here a picture that reminds us that for the past century and a half, the world population has increased steadily, and that the consumption of energy per capita also has increased steadily, although having slowed down after the oil shocks in 73 and 79. These two curves, they both contribute for a very very rapid growth of worldwide supply of primary energy. And that's the graph provided by the International Energy Agency, where you can see how dramatically the world supply of primary energy has increased since about the mid-century, past 20th century, with a very large contribution coming from oil and an increasing fraction of gas and coal as well. In this graph, we see how along the ages the consumption of energy has been increasing and how it has been spent by different civilizations along centuries or millennia. Nowadays, technological civilization spends much energy, about on average nearly 1 kilowatt per capita, most being in productive activities, industry and agriculture in white, but also very large shares in transport and commerce and in domestic economy, housing, services and so on. Say, the average world is a composition, a combination of these last three columns. Because you know that people on Africa don't live like people in North America. As a matter of fact, today, reality is a combination of these last three columns. Now, looking at the world supply of crude oil and all liquid fuels, I have these pictures to draw your attention to the main source of energy supply in the whole world. And we see that conventional crude oil and all liquid fossil fuels, they are growing steadily, notwithstanding the fact that the growth rate has diminished after the first and second oil shocks. On the right, you can see the contribution coming from the so-called non-conventional oil. So what is on the right is the wedge between those two curves on the left-hand side. The scales are different. This has expanded. And you see what are the contributions from natural gas liquids, polar oil, oil sands, extra crude oil, and biofuels. They are relatively small contributions, but important to maintain the steady growth of overall liquid hydrocarbon liquid. This graph also depicts the growth of the last few years since 2005. You have entered the plateau. Notwithstanding, in the, this corner down here, notwithstanding increase, but a very tiny increase in biofuels. This graph shows very, in a very brief way, how different countries or regions in the world consume their energy by primary energy source and how much they consume according to per capita consumption, vertical axis, and according to the population, horizontal axis. Now, going deeper into hydrocarbon resources and supply. There are a number of issues that should be addressed. This graph illustrates how the exploration effort that has been developed along 150 years has conducted to discoveries of reserves of hydrocarbons, and particularly oil, crude oil. And we see how a small effort has produced large amounts of cumulative reserves in the Middle East, and how these curves have developed differently in different regions, including Europe, that's in brown, the second from the bottom. You see how difficult, how much effort it has been necessary to develop number of wells drilled to be able to attain a cumulative amount of reserves that doesn't attain even 100 billion barrels of oil. This graph also illustrates the effort, now not in number of wells being drilled, but in time, elapsed time, since 1920. And we see that cumulative reserves have grown very fast in the class of very big reservoirs in black. On the contrary, tiny, small reservoirs in blue, they have been growing steadily but at a very slow rate. That picture suggests that most reserves that have been found are found in very big reservoirs, easy to find and easy to explore. And this picture illustrates that fact, that very important fact, that 14 reservoirs, hydrocarbon reservoirs, provide 20% of the oil being produced worldwide. These are the supergiant reservoirs. Very few countries have one or two of them. Very few. There are 14 worldwide. On the opposite end, we have over 4,000 small reservoirs that altogether provide 53% of oil. So, roughly speaking, very tiny reservoirs produce half of the oil, and the other half of the oil is produced by big reservoirs, of which a large percentage are very a small percentage of reservoirs produce a large amount. So production is highly concentrated. The other problem they should address is that we have to prospect oil and gas in places where you never have explored before. And this illustrates the prospection and actual production in deep offshore, that means in the sea, at the seafloor, deeper than 200 meters. And we see how far you have to go to find oil in the offshore. This graph is no longer updated, it's 4 years old, and at that time, prospection or exploration was going on at nearly 3,000 meters depth, and actual production was already attained nearly 2,000 meters depth, very harsh circumstances. and very expensive. The same could be said about polar oil, oil in polar regions. Antarctica is protected. You cannot explore Antarctica in point of view of economical exploration. But the Arctic has been prospected and has started to be exploited in Alaska and in Norway and Russia. The production has already started in very harsh conditions, in offshore and in extreme low temperatures that make the process very difficult. Also, to draw your attention to another point is that when extracting oil, gas as well, but particularly oil, it is easy at first. It gushes out, but afterward you have to put pressure in to have enhanced oil recovery to be able to keep going the production. And eventually you have to resort to extreme means that are meant, they are told there. And in any case, if you attain 50% recovery of the oil in place, you are doing very well. Now, there is another point that should be addressed as well. EROI is short for energy return on energy invested, measures how much energy, say, oil barrels, needs to be spent in order to extract another barrel of oil. EROI decreases from stage to stage, and the recovery of oil in place is never complete. Once the EROI of a primary energy source approaches one, it makes no physical sense to produce it. You spend more than you get back. The EROI of oil is shrinking fast. It has already shrunk by approximately a factor of 10. It is currently somewhere around 10. So it fell from 100 in early in the first quarter of past century to about 10 today. These estimates are difficult to have exact estimates because of lack of industrial data that properly might account for the calculations. But that's the effect is there for sure. This graph illustrates how oil and condensate, liquid condensates in green, have developed along the past centuries. And in red you have the discoveries that have been accumulated in the past century as well. These very fast up and going lines are the discoveries. And the more steadily curves, they represented the consumption of oil and gas worldwide. You see how gas and oil worldwide are increasing whenever, whereas the discoveries are declining. And this is made clear, more clearly here in this other graph, where we have taken 5-year averages for discoveries and for production, and where it becomes clearly evident that since the early 80s, the extraction of oil has outpassed and is outpassing more and more the discoveries. So we are using back our reserves. You have an account in the bank we are withdrawing the money from the bank, and the bank doesn't provide an interest rate on what we have there. The same happens with the gas, although the extraction of gas has overtaken the discovery only more recently, only 10 years ago. Oil, conventional or regular oil, unconventional oil, heavy oil, deep water, coal, gas liquid, and other categories of non-conventional oil. And this table that is based on the ultimate reserves are not conservative,
according to the
year 2008, for a reserve of oil of all categories. Although heavy oil, deep water oil, and coal oil and gas liquid will grow in future. But that growth is not enough to compensate for the decline, pronounced decline, of regular. And this picture now shows how many countries have been producing oil along the past century, have passed the peak of their production capacity, and they have entered into decline, country after country. And you see that just half a dozen of countries have not yet attained the peak of production capacity. Of course, here are not mentioned the former Soviet Union, and are not mentioned the Middle East countries, because the Middle East countries. But altogether, there are and things is a little more complicated or more difficult, because those countries that still manage to produce large amounts of oil, they are comparatively richer and tend to be growing faster their economies, investing
there. Tem? Tem ou não? Estás bom? Está bom?
capacity by mid-century. And putting all fossil fuels together, green is for oil, red is for natural gas, black is for coal, We see them all put together, and is shown in blue, the big peak. It goes through a maximum somewhere in the next 1-2 decades. In this graph is also shown projections for the world population, keeping growing and then entering some sort of steady state or decline of world population. It is not my guess either. It's United Nations and International Institute of Applied Systems Analysis. Putting this data together, you see that the consumption per capita of all fossil fuels, and all fossil fuels, they represent nowadays 85% of world energy, primary energy supply. All fossil fuels together, per capita, you see that they represent a phenomenon in human history that lasts only 2 centuries. And that in a few decades, we are going through the peak of this this era or epoch of fossil fuels. In a few decades, we cannot count on them to keep our economic growth or maintain our economy level. The same can be said of material resources, renewable or not renewable. We see this graph of, in the United States, for instance, 20th century, the growth of gross domestic product has gone faster, but not much faster than material consumption and energy consumption. And as far as materials are concerned, also taking the example of the United States, that's a very well-studied object case. Here is the composition of material consumption. The largest share on the top are construction materials, and underneath are industrial minerals, and underneath recycled metals and primary metals. And only at the very bottom are wood products and agriculture products. The very bottom. Resource extraction and depletion. Even the renewable resources are depletable if you extract them at a rate higher than the replenishment, that the rate of reposition. That is true with water in the wells, is true with fisheries, and that graph shows, illustrates that case. How are depleted fisheries, and how some are on the other side, some are still under-exploited. In this example, as historical examples as well, on the left-hand side you see the case of whaling. In the mid of 19th century, whaling, fishing whales, was very important for the very many products extracted from whales, oil, bone, and other products. And we see that the production of oil went through a peak and then declined. And this, already in this century, and second half of this century, the same as happened with sturgeon for production of caviar, and not only caviar, it went through a peak. It was overexploited. So overexploitation of overdevelopment of renewable resources are not sustainable. As far as mineral resources coming from the crust, we see that only a tiny amount, rather less than 1%, represents the so-called base metals that are essential for our economy: copper, nickel, zinc, lead, and some other ones. They exist in very tiny quantities. And it is important to draw your attention to the fact that as we extract the ores from the mines, that with cumulative production of these ores, extraction or production of these ores, the grade of these ores decline from the left to the right. And as the grade declines, the energy cost of extracting and processing the ore to obtain the final product increases steadily, and also how the recovery rate of the product is decreasing. That means the fraction of material in place that I can recover to enter the economy is diminishing. These cumulative effects determine that a large number of important mineral products are becoming scarce. This historical example of copper in the United States, you see how along 2.5 centuries the grade of the ore has declined consistently, at the same time as the stock of copper in the economy of the United States has been growing. It has been growing. But the grade of the ore and the cost, economic and energy cost of extracting it, is going higher and higher up. And this illustrates graphically how the inputs coming from nature relate to the outputs going to the economy, both in mass and in energy. This represents the system of extracting, processing, concentrating, refining and obtaining the metal, in this case copper, but could be otherwise. And you see the proportion between input and output, and the proportion of waste is going down here. This is case of gold. And you look at this picture, it reminds us of the case of oil. You see that the gold, and in several countries, large producer countries, the gold production has been declining for a number of years. Is the case of South Africa, is the case of the United States, and so on. All different producers are going through a peak capacity and falling down. And overall, there is signs that you have passed the peak capacity of production of gold worldwide. That's because the cost of extraction, it, energy and economical cost of extraction is becoming exceedingly high. Many of the major companies are not keeping up with reserve replacement and are also showing declining production and reserve profiles. Lower average ore grade and higher production costs are occurring. Like gold, several high-tech materials are scarce, energy-intensive, and expensive. And we have this graph showing how Europe is dependent from other countries for importing some very special materials that are essential for the high-technology society. You will see or South Africa, they have nearly the monopoly of some rare metals. The same being said of Russia and China, Australia and South America. And we are dependent on these imports. Notwithstanding the efforts that the mining industry is accumulating in the last few years, notwithstanding that growing efforts of exploration, investing in finding more reserves, the situation is as depicted. And this graph shows in a very clear way, even for iron, that now is going to have a spot market, is not going to be sold, traded in the long range, will be traded in spot market, that also for iron, in the case of the United States here is illustrated in brown, that's the reserves, what is below the ground, and in other colors, what is above the ground. And we see that in the United States, roughly half of the iron has moved from below ground to above the ground. And that's for iron. That's the material that you would have considered to be granted, that would never be short of. And as a matter of fact, we have gone so far having moved it from underground to above ground.
Professor Namorado, nós vamos ter mesmo que...
Yeah. Of course. I apologize for being so long. Of course, my message is longer. It will be in the PowerPoint that will be available to you. And I was too long out of my enthusiasm, and I am very grateful before this distinguished audience for having paid attention to me. Thank you very much.
Os meus agradecimentos ao professor Namorado Rosa e com as nossas desculpas pelo facto de ter gerido o tempo um pouco mais curto. Nós vamos fazer aqui um ponto de situação dos nossos trabalhos, porque nós estamos com o nosso tempo atrasado, e eu acho que é fundamental nós agora fazermos um ponto de situação para ver se nós conseguimos cumprir os objetivos com o pouco tempo que nos resta. E vou pedir um pouco, digamos, da generosidade do professor Paulo Ferrão para ver se nós conseguimos fazer aqui um parênteses relativamente aos trabalhos. Já estão a ser disponibilizadas as versões em inglês e em português da nossa proposta de resolução. A versão em francês esteve disponível mais cedo e penso que já vos foi distribuída. As versões em inglês e em português estão também disponíveis neste momento e também estão a ser, ou irão ser, começar a ser distribuídas. Como vos havia dito, esta versão última, que vos vai ser distribuída, ou que já tenha no vosso poder, caso seja em francês, resultou da incorporação das propostas que nos fizeram chegar até hoje de madrugada. Não contemplam as propostas que entregaram hoje de manhã, como é natural. O que eu proponho, em termos metodológicos, é o seguinte. Eu sei que há colegas que entendem que ainda devem apresentar propostas ou de alteração, ou propostas de eliminação, ou propostas de aditamento ao conteúdo que está proposto como projeto de resolução. Eu irei pedir-vos para que apresentem as vossas propostas por escrito, para que nós possamos gerir este processo de alteração do conteúdo. Iria estabelecer, se estivessem de acordo, um deadline, um tempo, digamos, que seria cerca de 15 minutos após terem na vossa posse as versões finais. Eu penso que é suficiente, uma vez que já têm certamente conhecimento através das versões em francês que estão a circular. Portanto, neste momento são 11h55, até às 12h15 nós receberíamos as últimas propostas que entendessem apresentar. Pedia-vos o favor que o fizessem por escrito, isso permitir-nos-á gerir melhor todo o processo de elaboração do texto final. Eu ia pedir ao apoio do secretariado que fizesse o favor de incorporar as vossas propostas, para ver se no final, imediatamente após a intervenção do professor Paulo Ferrão, nós estávamos em condições de vos apresentar o texto final e submetê-lo à vossa consideração. É muito importante que saibam que o nosso trabalho tem sido feito com uma única finalidade, que esta resolução da 16ª Conferência Interparlamentar seja um documento que transcreva fiel e objetivamente aquilo que é o pensamento dos congressistas, dos conferencistas que participam nesta conferência. Tem sido esse o nosso farol, a nossa finalidade, e vamos tentar cumpri-la até, digamos, à parte final do nosso trabalho de presidência. Por isso agradeço a vossa compreensão, a vossa generosidade, a vossa colaboração, para ver se nós conseguimos às 12h15 ter um texto final consolidado para vos colocar à consideração e para que se possam pronunciar acerca dele. Eu iria passar a palavra ao professor Paulo Ferrão, iria pedir ao professor Namorado Rosa que me substituísse na presidência desta mesa, porque eu vou deslocar-me para os bastidores para dar uma ajuda, digamos, na consolidação do texto da resolução.
Distinguished Parliament members, dear friends, I'm very impressed with the work you are doing, and of course we are very glad that the parliaments across all these states are worried with the science, are promoting science, and certainly promoting sustainability and energy. And I also understand that my role is not very flexible, so depending on the time you have for making your resolutions, I need to entertain you, so it could be shorter or longer. I will try to manage this according to your benefit. So, certainly, my talk is now very easy after Professor Namorado Rosa, because he has already provided all the grounds, and really what I'm trying to provide now is a vision into the future. So, we have all these problems, we have all these constraints, and also I think I would just make a brief appointment on what I see, and bringing now again the words of Professor Murat Rosa, the metabolism of a crisis. We live nowadays a crisis, and the crisis has a lot to do with all of which have been said. I have here a very brief picture which I would like to share with you. Consider that our economies, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the French, the British, etc., so is within our domestic land. And in this economy, there are many materials of many inputs of different materials that come both from domestic and from imports. So I will call for now, I would just like you to retain one name, which is DMI, Direct Material Input. This is the number of tons of materials that enter from the national or foreign land to the economy. Say, for example, this is the food we eat, this is the materials we import or take from the ground to build our houses, etc. And all the rest, so what goes out of the economy can be exports and useful products, but all the rest is automatically, say, transformed in waste or in pollution. I would like to shock you by saying that in average, for example, if you consider a city, in 6 months, only 1% of the materials that entered in this city were useful. 99% are garbage or are pollution. And of course, this is very relevant. Not only this is relevant, this is a study that we have been making during the last years. And I would like to now try to explain this graph because I think it's important. So, if you remember, this DMI, so the direct material input, is the amount of tons that each citizen in the world, this is a graphic which we have made valid through statistics all over the world and on the last 50 years. So this is the number of tons that each citizen in average in this world consumed per year along the human development. And what does this say? And this is represented as a function of GDP per capita. For example, countries like China or India, which might have a GDP per capita about, say, $5,000 per less than $5,000 per year, consume about 5 or 6 tons per capita per year. So it means that each citizen eats 5 or 6 tons of materials per year. What the world has shown is that there is this universal rule which says that across the progress of the nations and the economic development, there is a linear relationship between what is the earnings, what is the GDP of the countries, and their material consumption. Now imagine what will be this world with China and India growing their GDP per capita, at the same time they increase proportionally the material consumption, and of course this makes us an unsustainable world. On the other hand, it looks like that we have a magic number of a GDP about $15,000 per capita, on which the behavior of the society changes and we have a kind of a plateau where the material consumption does not grow. But the problem is, this is not a Kuznets curve, for those which are economists, this is not decreasing again. So most probably we will have a rebound effect. This is a huge problem. I used to say in Portugal, and we have made studies to explain, Portugal during the last decade has made this evolution in year, so we have passed from an economy like this to an economy like this. I used to say that this is the mechanism of the economy which is typical of concrete, of building, 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 building. And now we need to change the paradigm to an economy that stops building and starts sinking. So promoting innovation, promoting added value based on science, and I think this is your most main motivation, so I don't need to explain a lot and to elaborate a lot about this, but it is my firm conviction that we need to put all our efforts in Europe to change this direction. Now, having said this, for energy, this is the same thing. I was analyzing all the materials, but if we look at energy, it is exactly the same graph. GDP per capita correlates with energy consumption, and of course this is a huge trouble for all of us. And then, if you look to the ecological footprint, of course I will not detail a lot on this, but it is very clear, if we go like this, we would already need 20 or 30% Earths. Very easily, in 2030, we'll need to have 2 Earths to feed us to support this model of development. We do not have 2 Earths, so of course we do need to do something. We need to change the paradigm in which we are. And that's, I think, very clear and does not need further evidence. Now, okay, shall we be unhappy? No, we should be happy and try to do things, and the world leaders are aware about the situation. I'm not saying anything new, just providing evidence. And of course in the EU has been leading this process of modernizing energy and environment. And we have already set up some very, very ambitious targets, like promoting 20% energy savings by 2020, promoting 20% GHG emissions reduction, improving and enhancing the contribution for renewable energies. And for example, I was this week as the national representative to the steering committee of the energy set plan in Brussels. And it was announced that the recovery plan that the EU is putting together includes 3 major investments in this area. One is on energy efficiency in buildings, the other is on electrical cars, and the other is on future manufacturing systems. And this is very important as it provides us important guidelines on the future. Similarly, the new US administration had just released a strategy by which, in their recovery plan, they want to invest in energy efficiency and they want to create with that about 2 million jobs. 2 million jobs doing what? Retrofitting buildings, expanding mass transit and freight rail, constructing smart electrical grids, wind power, solar power, next generation of biofuels. What I want to bring here now is that the policy in Europe and the US are now perfectly aligned along these objectives. And of course, Barack Obama just stated that our country cannot afford politics as usual. The consequences of inaction are so dangerous, and the National Science Foundation just released a new study where it really promotes, engages the U.S. in transforming their economy to be a sustainable energy economy. So the policy alignment is out there. Now we need action, we need to change, and we need to change through the people. Of course, I need to tell you about the MIT Portugal program very briefly. The Portuguese government decided 2 years ago to engage a major partnership with MIT. This is the second world largest partnership of MIT across the world, the first being Singapore, the second is Portugal. What is this about? Well, The major objective of this partnership was to develop in Europe the idea of engineering systems. Engineering systems means that we try to solve relevant problems to the populations by bringing together technology, economy, and social sciences. And this is a multidisciplinary effort. And based on this, we have created four new areas in this program, which correspond, as I will explain in a minute, to the creation of four completely new PhD programs and master programs. These areas are engineering design and advanced manufacturing, transportation systems, sustainable energy systems, and bioengineering systems. Of course, the program works in a way that we have joined different universities across the country, so it's not a single university. And this was maybe the most important result of the first phase of the program, which is to have different universities working together in Portugal, providing PhD theses together, providing research together, because of course the solutions in any part of this of the world need critical mass. If we are not together, it will be very difficult that by scattering the efforts we will raise some solution. And this was the primary mission of MIT Portugal. Those of you which work with universities know it's not so easy to put different universities collaborating. This was achieved together with the glue of MIT. And then of course the program is now on its second and a half year. And we have been able to put together these PhD programs. We have now already engaged in the program 154 PhD students from almost all the countries in Europe. So we are attracting a lot of students from different countries. And then the programs go like this. So we have joint teaching by Portuguese faculty and MIT faculty in Portugal with the minor participation of MIT faculty. And then the students will engage in the PhD, and which takes about 3 years. They always have a Portuguese supervisor and an MIT supervisor, and then they spend 1 year at MIT. And this is working, I would say, very satisfactorily. I will now turn to the Sustainable Energy Systems Program, as it is more aligned with this conference, to say that what we want to do in the Sustainable Energy Systems Program is to provide an innovative degree and an innovative approach in the following terms. Technologies, we know, are there. Problems are there. Now we need to bring the technologies together to solve the problems in place, in the different regions, and this cannot be done without regional flavor. And in order to do this, we have to invest a lot in promoting solutions that are relevant to regions, that are relevant to urban areas, that are relevant to the locations. And then the first effort we have to do is, for example, we have plenty of macro energy models developed. We have micro energy models developed. It is very hard to find in the world models that can fit the big dimension and the small dimension geography terms in time scale, and that is one of the main objectives of this program. And this involves, and that's what I would like to provide now as a vision for the future, we are changing the energy paradigm. Up until now, we had, for example, electricity producers, big power plants, and then we flow energy across the country and to satisfy the demand wherever it was. This has numerous problems. This has problems, of course, of a lot of the energy is wasted in the centralized production, and then we go on wasting energy across the distribution, and then, of course, it is very hard to combine different forms of energy in the consumption, and we, again, lose opportunities. It is very obvious that the future is not this one. The future is the future for decentralization. So each consumer could be also a producer. And if we want to produce renewables, this is inherent to the renewable energy production. So to use the solar energy in our houses, either thermal or electrical through the photovoltaics, to enhance the production of wind, to enhance the production of geothermal, all of these requires two very important elements: the distribution, but also the combination of different sources of energy. And all of this is very complex, is impossible to do in a centralized way. So what will be the rationale of my presentation for the next slides is we are nowadays looking forward to a revolution on the society as we attend it for the internet. To this I will call the energy net. So this is the energy internet. We are really now going to feel that the energy world will become the internet of the future. And this will be a major revolution, full of opportunities to all of us, full of opportunities to all that can get a good hand on it. And that is certainly the main purpose of the MIT Portugal program, to support this country and Europe to grab a little bit of the future. So, we have all these problems. What are the alternatives for the future? To do nothing? It's an alternative for very few, I hope. And then we have two other alternatives: to reduce demand by improving energy efficiency, by promoting demand side management, making pricing mechanisms. We could, of course, promote the better, more use of renewable energies like wind, solar, biomass. But this is not enough. We need to do both at the same time. So we need to combine these approaches, and I would like to show you our vision on why this needs to happen. And this I will call again the energy software, which combines electrical, intelligent networks, which combines the housing and the mobility, combines the cars and the increase in the renewable energies penetration. And all of these we are working in the MIT Portugal program and making a big demonstration project in one of our islands in São Miguel, in the Azores, which we want to make as an example how we can, for example, in this case, raise renewable energy penetration from 40% to over 80%. Of course, this is a very difficult challenge, and this can only be accomplished by joining, of course, the university and different companies, and all the major companies in Portugal, like the EDP, that was with you yesterday, EFASEC, Galp Energia, Martifer, more recently SCC Energia with biofuels, are cooperating with us in this project. I would just like to give you a flavor of what we are doing there. Certainly, in order to do something wherever it is, we need to understand the local reality in social terms. So what are the drivers for energy consumption? What are the opportunities for people? And then, of course, designing and scoping scenarios, trying to explain where we spend the energy, and then to try to analyze different alternatives, put design scenarios, and then to go from the design scenarios to the implementation phase. This is, for example, and I will not be too exhaustive on this, but let me just challenge you with a major figure, which I think it is important for policy purpose. If you look at this plot, you see in the left-hand side the primary energy which fuels this island. And this is a big island. This has about 120,000 people, so it's not a small thing. And on the right-hand side, we have the energy services. So all our orientation is to be demand-driven. What we want is to satisfy these demands, which are, what are energy demands? Energy demands are for lighting, for heating, for cooling, for transporting people. So I don't care about oil or gas or wind. So that comes later. And then, if you look there for the electricity production, you have an arrow in a kind of orange source, which is geothermal power. You see geothermal power there, goes through the conversion process and produces electricity. And geothermal power in São Miguel produces nowadays about 50% of the electricity required in São Miguel. But you are not lying if you say, looking at that geothermal power produces supplies less than 10% of the primary energy. This is not contradictory, and in policy terms you can really play with these numbers. So what is very clear in this case, as in all the cases across Europe and the world, and the developed world, is that this ball here over here, the service here, transportation, of course nowadays fully rely on cars, and the cars consume a lot of oil. So you cannot do in any system if you don't address the transportation properly. And what I would like to show you now is that we have another challenge. Consider this is a one-day pattern of consumption of electricity. So during the night, you consume very few electricity, and of course, during the day, you have the peak consumption. Now, imagine that in the case of São Miguel, you have about 30 megawatts of production of geothermal. Imagine that you want to double, which is theoretically possible. What will happen is that during the night you will have no use for the electricity. And that is the reason why they cannot increase the electricity, renewable electricity production. But during the day, you will miss a lot of electricity. So, of course, the obvious response is that you need to improve the storage system. But storing electricity or storing energy is not so easy. So you need to find intelligent ways of doing that. Of course, one, for the countries which have a lot of hydro, dams are a solution. For example, as you will see today in our dam here in Alqueva, which is a reversible dam, which can, of course, pump, make pump storage. But you can do better than that. And the problem is that the dynamics of renewable, say, of course, wind is an important one, and the dynamics of demand are very different. So you, again, need a different way to do this. Our goal in this project is to develop technologies that bring together buildings, transportation, and renewables all together to solve this problem. Let me give you a flavor on how. Consider, for example, an home. In the home, we have a lot of places where we spend energy. What we are doing now, and I will with this trying to illustrate the concept of the Internet of Energy, we are doing now the following. We are developing demonstration projects where we will put a small chip in each of the main electrical equipments. And imagine that this chip will provide you information on the consumption, the instantaneous consumption of a given equipment, and this information will circulate through the electrical cables by PowerNet. So you don't need to put any other appliance. You just have here a chip and then you pass the information. At the central level in the home, in the board, in the switching board, you will have an equipment which decodes this information, and this equipment can pass this information to the internet. So you can be wherever you are in the world, and you can be looking at how the consumption now in your house is taking place. And you can see the consumption varying, and you can even see the details of what is consuming what. So if you have that in a computer, from that moment on, you can do whatever you want to those consumptions, bringing in mind that this chip can also cut the electricity or put down the consumption. And this is so important, because with this, if you have the perfect alignment and the perfect regulation provided certainly by parliament in the different countries, you can do the following. Imagine a system like that island. We choose an island because it's the most difficult system. There is no grid. Whatever you do needs to be done there. We don't have Spain to support us or otherwise with the electrical grid. The question is, if you have a moment in the consumption where you have a lot of renewable energy, the grid can speak with the house by pricing and say, well, now you have extremely cheap electricity. And at the same time, I have my electrical car plugged in my house, and then the car, which is connected now to the computer, to the information system, will say, well, this is wonderful, because electricity is so cheap that I will now charge my batteries. And of course, by doing that, I am solving, without further cost, the problem of energy storage. And then in the morning, there is a lack of wind, the price signal is given to the house, the price, imagine that in this future, near future, the price will be allowed to fluctuate to the personal consumers, and the car, I will come to the car, and the car will tell me, oh, today you should not go by car. The electricity is so expensive that I will stay in home, the car, I will stay in home, selling electricity to the grid, and I will make your day. So take another way of transportation. And then, of course, this solves the problem, part of the problem, of the electricity supply, because we have lack of electricity in the grid. So this is a fantastic solution for demand side management, and believe me, as you know, all the countries in the world, particularly in Europe, are looking very, very much for this. So this is the concretization of this idea of the energy internet. So we are going to a world where we no longer have information in one side, we have energy in another side, they will be merged together, and I firmly believe that this will be the next revolution, the major revolution that will happen in the world, and Portugal wants to be part of it, and certainly we want to invite and to have all the European partners here participating in this revolution, and this is one of the major objectives of the MIT Portugal program. So, what I would like to say in this case is that if we join the effort of all the houses, if we join, of course, pump storage, for example, in the Azores, we are even thinking about seawater pump storage, which is a much more tricky thing. And what we want to develop really is this plug, considering that we no longer have an internet plug and an electric cable, but of course we have both together and we can combine energy and information. And the beauty of this is that these jobs are local. There are no unique international solutions for this. We need to build the solutions locally. We need to create jobs locally with local skills, so this will affect a job recovery in a time. So I promise to finish when Nico Bravo will arrive. I am finishing to say so that this is our vision for the system of the future that combines different technologies that will make the electricity world, the energy world, brighter. And what we want to do above all is to invest on people, to create the leaders of the future of this world, and to bring together scientists and our PhD students, to bring them together with the people that are working in factories, making the devices to have this possible. And of course we count on a lot of support from the parliaments, from the politicians, and from initiatives like Eureka to have a brighter and best future that will be able to take the opportunity that it is in our hands. Thank you very much.
Muito obrigado ao professor Paulo Ferrão. Com as minhas desculpas de não poder ter assistido e ter perdido uma ótima oportunidade de aprendizagem e de conhecimento, mas estive nos bastidores a tentar consolidar a versão final do nosso projeto de resolução. Está pronto. Nós recebemos há 2 minutos as últimas 3 ou 4 propostas de alteração. Foi mesmo, como se costuma dizer no nosso país, até ao lavar dos cestos se fez a vindima. Foi mesmo até ao último minuto que a proposta de resolução teve o vosso contributo, que eu, novamente, vos agradeço, pois foi um contributo extraordinário, muito participado, muito interativo e que possibilitou, penso eu, na minha modesta e humilde opinião, chegarmos a um projeto de resolução desta 16ª Conferência, que tem, enfim, penso eu, bastante transparente e de forma bastante integrada todas as vossas diversas e múltiplas opiniões. A versão que vos foi distribuída é a versão que a doutora Cristina Tavares, nosso staff, tem ali projetado. É o conteúdo consolidado. Nesse conteúdo que nós chegámos como versão final, foram introduzidas 3 ou 4 pequenas alterações que eu vou pedir à doutora Cristina que vos indique para as submeter à vossa consideração. Portanto, o texto que está a passar é o texto que todos os colegas têm na vossa posse. E agora temos ali uma proposta apresentada pela delegação espanhola que propõe a substituição do termo científica por transnacional. Eu quero perguntar aos colegas conferencistas se há alguém que se oponha a esta substituição desta palavra científica pela palavra transnacional. Não havendo, considerámo-la aceite e então o texto passará a incorporar o termo transnacional. Muito obrigado. Segunda alteração. É uma alteração que está incluída no ponto número 4. E que tem a ver com a existência ou não de um observatório possa monitorizar a atividade da Eureka. Há duas propostas em alternativa. Uma proposta da Espanha, da delegação espanhola, para incluir o conteúdo que está ali. É uma proposta que já veio do dia de ontem. E há hoje uma proposta da delegação alemã que nos propõe a supressão deste parágrafo. Eu iria, em primeiro lugar, pedir à delegação alemã que está aqui entre nós se mantém a sua proposta de eliminação deste parágrafo do ponto número 4. Eu não sei onde estão os colegas alemães, estão ou bem ali. E fazia também a pergunta aos colegas espanhóis, naturalmente, se mantêm a vossa proposta de inclusão. Mantemos. Muito bem. Então temos aqui... Sim, por favor. Faz favor. Eu perguntava às delegações espanhola e alemã se poderiam eventualmente negociar este parágrafo para ver se poderiam chegar a uma formulação que fosse consensual entre as duas delegações, porque penso que da nossa parte, enfim, não querendo falar em nome de mais ninguém a não ser de mim, mas penso que não haveria problema em incluir uma formulação que fosse consensual às duas delegações. Eu convidava os colegas da Alemanha e da Espanha a tentarem chegar a um acordo enquanto nós continuávamos na observação das propostas seguintes. Temos agora uma proposta, no ponto número 6, uma proposta de eliminação daquelas duas palavras. De acordo com a justificação da delegação alemã, são palavras que, digamos, são redundantes naquele contexto. Eu pergunto-vos se alguém se opõe à eliminação daquelas duas palavras na formulação deste ponto. Não havendo, consideramos aprovada essa proposta alemã e agradeço-vos e peço. Temos agora uma proposta da delegação espanhola de inclusão destes termos no ponto número 6 e coloco-vos à consideração esta proposta, perguntando se alguém se opõe à sua inclusão no ponto número 6. Não havendo nenhuma oposição, consideramos-la aprovada e integra a nossa proposta de resolução no ponto número 6. E não temos mais nenhuma proposta e aguardamos agora a possibilidade de um entendimento. Entretanto, eu vou aproveitar a ocasião para agradecer ao professor Paulo Ferrão e ao professor Rui Namorado Rosa as respectivas participações, o contributo que deram a esta 16ª conferência. O nosso agradecimento em nome de todos. Muito obrigado. Iria e vou, neste momento, enquanto decorrem as negociações, informar-vos de que a conferência tem entre nós o Sr. Presidente da Comissão Parlamentar de Educação e Ciência, que teve disponibilidade e muito nos honra com a sua presença aqui hoje em Évora. Contrariamente à informação que eu vos tinha dado, é com enorme gosto que eu chamo o Sr. Deputado António José Seguro para aqui nos acompanhar na sessão de encerramento. Senhoras e senhores congressistas, eu ia pedir-vos, sei que é difícil, mas nós temos que encerrar esta 16ª conferência. Eu ia pedir aos nossos serviços de apoio só mais 2 minutos de alguma tranquilidade para nós podermos encerrar formalmente a 16ª Conferência Interparlamentar Eureka. Eu volto a repetir, por favor, para a ala direita do nosso auditório, aos senhores e senhores congressistas, o favor de aguardarem só mais dois minutos para nós encerrarmos. E dava de imediato a palavra ao Sr. Presidente da Comissão Parlamentar de Educação e Ciência da Assembleia da República Portuguesa, Sr. Deputado António José Seguro.
Muito obrigado, meu querido bravo Nico, minhas senhoras e meus senhores. Serei muito breve. Em primeiro lugar, dizer-vos que tenho muito gosto em estar aqui nesta sessão de encerramento para me associar a esta conferência e partilhar convosco a satisfação de, no âmbito do Parlamento Português, a Comissão a que tenho a honra de presidir, a Comissão Parlamentar de Educação e Ciência, ter sido escolhida para poder associar-se e, de alguma forma, orientar a realização desta conferência. Isto significa para nós o reconhecimento de um trabalho na área da ciência que temos vindo a fazer designadamente no final desta legislatura e não apenas um ritual ou um encargo ou visto como, muito menos, um fardo na realização de uma iniciativa desta natureza. E por isso destacámos um dos nossos melhores membros para presidir a esta conferência. E por isso as minhas primeiras palavras são para felicitar o meu colega Bravo Nico pela excelente presidência que fez desta conferência e que, estou certo, expressou bem o sentir quer do povo português e dos seus colegas deputados, que alguns aqui estão presentes, como o meu colega José Soeiro, mas também a prioridade a que o Parlamento Português e a Comissão Parlamentar de Educação dedica às questões da ciência. Muito obrigado, meu querido Bravo Nico. A segunda nota, também muito breve, tem a ver, eu acho que merece. A segunda nota é para vos saudar. Eu não tive, infelizmente, a oportunidade de participar nos trabalhos de ontem, só pude hoje associar-me através desta presença no final desta conferência, mas tive relatos pormenorizados do vosso trabalho. Gostava de vos saudar, de agradecer muito a vossa presença. Sei que a iniciativa Eureka está num momento de pujança e sei que muitos pedem mais Eureka para a Europa e também mais Eureka fora das fronteiras da Europa. Eu gostava de me associar a esse pedido, mas gostava sobretudo de exigir que a Europa dedicasse mais políticas sólidas e mais recursos financeiros ao apoio à ciência e à investigação na própria Europa. Se nós confrontarmos aquilo que eram os objetivos da Agenda de Lisboa no que diz respeito aos seus propósitos para 2010, verificámos que ficámos muito aquém daquilo que eram os desejos e as intenções dos governos nessa altura. E por isso a ciência não pode ser uma peninha no chapéu. A ciência tem que corresponder, e a aposta na ciência, a uma prioridade na construção não só de uma Europa diferente, no que diz respeito ao seu modelo económico e social, mas também do ponto de vista do desenvolvimento mundial. E por isso eu gostava de deixar esta nota, num momento em que se fala de crise, mas que muitos confundem o sintoma com as causas da crise. E eu julgo que uma das funções dos parlamentares e das parlamentares é exigirem aos executivos, quer no plano nacional, quer no plano europeu, que dotem as políticas de apoio à investigação de recursos suficientes. E para que a investigação, que produz conhecimento, possa fazer a simbiose, como está aliás no projeto de resolução, com a atividade económica, com as próprias empresas. E que tudo isso possa ser uma relação harmónica, sem burocracias, que possam entupir a criatividade e a inovação de que a economia europeia tanto carece. E por isso, saúdo muito a participação de colegas nossos parlamentares de outros países que aqui tiveram. Desejo-vos que a parte da tarde seja um momento para beneficiarem do conhecimento de uma região de Portugal muito bonita, que é o Alentejo e concretamente o Distrito de Évora. Tiveram ontem a possibilidade de estar numa cidade lindíssima, Lisboa, e hoje numa cidade de património mundial como é Évora, com monumentos fantásticos, e eu não direi mais nada, porque a hora do almoço aproxima-se, a não ser agradecer a vossa presença, que desfrutem das horas que ainda estão em Portugal e concretamente na região do Alentejo, e desejar as maiores felicidades a Israel, que irá acolher a próxima Conferência Eureka. Muito obrigado a todos.
Meus caros colegas, só meio minuto para saber se as delegações espanhola e alemã chegaram a um entendimento relativamente ao texto do ponto que havia, digamos, alguma discordância de tema. Não sei. Vocês estão em condições de nos informar? Sim, por favor. Se quiser vir aqui, por favor. Nós temos que aprovar aquilo que foi o entendimento. Há um acordo. Transnacional, muito bem. Eu vou perguntar aos senhores e às senhoras conferencistas se alguém se opõe ao texto que resulta daquele acordo entre a delegação espanhola e alemã para suprimirmos o único ponto que está ainda em aberto. Ninguém. Eu pergunto se alguém se opõe. Muito bem. Consideramos aprovado o texto final, consolidado da resolução da 16ª Conferência Interparlamentar Eureka 2009. O texto que têm com as 4 ou 5 alterações que foram feitas através das vossas propostas. Últimas palavras, muito breves. Eu penso que foram 2 dias, e são 2 dias, ainda estão a ser, mas até hoje foram 2 dias de um fantástico trabalho. Eu penso que esta conferência correspondeu às nossas expectativas, está a corresponder àquilo que nós desenhámos para que fosse uma iniciativa que promovesse a aprendizagem dos parlamentares relativamente à iniciativa Eureka, que pudéssemos conhecer um pouco mais do que é a iniciativa, pudéssemos conhecer um pouco mais da sua dinâmica, da sua história, do seu futuro, para que nós, parlamentares, possamos dar um contributo sério, um contributo construtivo para a consolidação da iniciativa Eureka. Como vos disse no primeiro dia, esta conferência interparlamentar inscreve-se no âmbito da presidência portuguesa da iniciativa. E eu queria aqui agradecer à presidência portuguesa da iniciativa Eureka, através da pessoa que é o seu responsável, que é o professor Nunes da Ponte, que ainda está connosco ali em cima, toda a colaboração que prestou ao Parlamento e particularmente a esta organização no desenho e na materialização da conferência. Os nossos agradecimentos por todo o apoio que nos foi prestado. Um agradecimento que eu também estendo ao Ministério da Ciência, da Tecnologia e do Ensino Superior, que também nos colocou, desde a primeira hora, todo um conjunto de informações e de disponibilidades em termos técnicos e de recursos humanos que nós também registamos. Gostaria também aqui agora de agradecer o fantástico apoio de todo o pessoal técnico do nosso Parlamento. Foram inexcedíveis no seu profissionalismo, na sua disponibilidade constante 24 horas sobre 24 horas e na sua simpatia sempre presente em cada momento crítico que nós vivemos e que ainda estamos a viver ao longo destes 2 dias. Os meus agradecimentos a todo o pessoal da Assembleia da República que prestou uma colaboração absolutamente extraordinária. E agradecer-vos a todos vós. Agradecer-vos a vossa presença no nosso país, no nosso Parlamento, na nossa terra. Agradecer-vos o vosso contributo, a vossa participação ativa através de um conjunto de propostas que melhoraram, que aumentaram a qualidade daquilo que foi o nosso trabalho inicial. E eu creio que esta conferência termina formalmente nesta sessão de encerramento e termina com a convicção de que cumpriu os seus objetivos e que aqueles que nela participaram penso que também cumpriram os objetivos que tinham quando aqui chegaram. Eu espero ter correspondido às expectativas da Assembleia da República, particularmente do Sr. Presidente da Comissão de Educação e Ciência, quando me entregou esta responsabilidade. A ideia que tinha era que se conseguisse organizar uma conferência interparlamentar. Ela aí está. Fez-se, eu penso que se fez com toda a capacidade que nós tínhamos, com toda a iniciativa e criatividade que nós tínhamos, e penso que cumprimos o nosso objetivo e a nossa missão. A que tinha pedido uma conferência, aqui a teve. E em Israel, lá teremos e lá estaremos todos para com os nossos colegas israelitas verificarmos o estado da Eureka daqui a 2 anos. A todos vós, o meu muito, muito, muito obrigado.
Muito bem. Muito bem.